Those who had followed John F. Kennedy looked to his brother, Robert, to pick up the torch.
I realize that as an individual, that we can't just look back, that we must look forward. When I think of President Kennedy, I think of what Shakespeare said in Romeo and Juliet, when he shall die, take him and cut him out into the stars, and he shall make the face of heaven so fine that all the world will be in love with night and pay no worship to the garish sun.
Robert Kennedy, a senator from New York, took up his brother's mantle in 1968, running for his party's presidential nomination, only to meet death at the hands of another assassin. Again, a Kennedy had fallen, and another Kennedy came forward.
My brother need not be idealized or enlarged in death beyond what he was in life. To be remembered simply as a good and decent man who saw wrong and tried to right it, saw suffering and tried to heal it, saw war and tried to stop it. Those of us who loved him and who take him to his rest today pray that what he was to us, what he wished for others, will someday come to pass for all the world. As he said many times in many parts of this nation, to those he touched and who sought to touch him, some men see things as they are and say, why? I dream things that never were and say, why not?
Edward M. Kennedy, youngest of the Kennedy family, last of the Kennedy sons, he had gotten into politics in Massachusetts, running for the Senate seat once held by John Kennedy until he was elected president. Teddy Kennedy ran in 62.
I think corruption. I think that anyone who seeks public office must do everything they possibly can, whether Democrat or Republican. I think there's an obligation upon every citizen to rid corruption from every aspect of our social system, whether it's in the people who are in public office, whether it's among the trade union movement, whether among business, whether among the journal, radio, and television, any area. I think there's an incumbent upon the people of Massachusetts to do everything they possibly can.
Are there any plans for other members of your family to participate in the campaign?
There are no present plans for any of them to participate. Of course, I'd appreciate all their votes.
Suddenly, the leader of the loyal Kennedy following, after the murders of John and Robert Kennedy, Ted Kennedy seemed a lonely and tragic figure. Most Americans expected him to eventually seek the presidency. That possibility became clouded, however, when yet another tragedy overcame the Kennedy family in August 1969. A car Kennedy was driving ran off a bridge, and a young woman riding with him was drowned. Edward Kennedy remained in the Senate, rising to the second highest position in the Democratic ranks in the Senate, but said he would not run for president in 1972. As the 60s, of which John Kennedy had so often spoken with hope, ended, so did the life of the founder of the remarkable Kennedy family. Ambassador Joseph Kennedy finally succumbed to a stroke that had left him an invalid for most of the years when his three sons stood upon the American political stage. The Kennedys, a family which not only dominated the decade of the 60s, but in some ways reflected those years. They lived with hope, yet met with tragedy. They had great wealth, yet their fates were beyond the control of that wealth. They smiled and they wept, and so did we all in the 60s. We reached the moon, but couldn't untangle the traffic on our streets. We cured disease, but were reluctant to erase poverty. We talked of peace, yet fought wars. We were in these years exactly as Charles Dickens wrote so long ago, living in the best of times and the worst of times. But we had time for laughs, too. Hubert Humphrey filled with enthusiasm for seeing America first.
You all ought to see Minnesota before you go. And I may I say, New York, New England, the Southwest, the Southeast, the Far West, the Northwest, and Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, and Hawaii and Alaska.
In the days when he was out of power and out of favor, Richard M. Nixon filled a lot of the time with sports, so much so that in the summer of 65, some people were suggesting him as a new commissioner for baseball.
I know there has been conjecture, which I appreciate, because as all of you gentlemen know, I'm a baseball fan, but I think probably the baseball commissionership will go to somebody else. I would not have the opportunity to give it the full time that it requires. It's the best offer I've had today.
Sports were always a way of getting away from it all. The 60s saw the growth of professional football in fans' favor, thanks to televised games. But always close to our hearts was baseball. And in baseball in the 1960s, there's only one story to tell, the story of the New York Mets. They called it the Cinderella team, and no wonder. Born in this decade, the Mets were the laughingstock of the majors as they fumbled and fiddled, trying just to win games, never mind anything like the pennant. And then, in 1969, it happened. And up Broadway to a ticker tape parade came the Mets, not just their division winner, not just their league winner, but number one, the world champions.
We're number one now, and they can't take it away from us. They said all year that, you know, these were a bunch of kids, and they got a good club, but that's about all they'd say. But what can you say now? You know, we're number one.
Ken Boswell here on the Mets Clubhouse champagne drinking time, and this is Brad Phillips, etche. Ron Taylor, who was the man who came in there on so many occasions in a pinch going back, I remember all the way to perhaps July, and those appearances meant a great deal to this team. Ron Taylor, world champions, and congratulations.
Thanks a lot, Brad. It's a great thrill to be a member of the Mets, and I think it was an especially satisfying win for the team today because now we are world champions, and we came back. We were down three runs. We came back and scored five to win it, and I'm just happy as I can be, and I'm just looking forward to a rest now from a long season.
Ron, how does this compare for you with your 1964 series with the Cardinals?
Well, there's no comparison at all. This is great. This is the greatest.
We're a ball club like we said we were all year.
We got the last laugh now.
We're going to have the last laugh. We can laugh a lot longer all winter.
Jerry Kirsten.
All winter. Plus, we can wear that little ring on our finger that says we're world champs.
Big ring. Big ring.
Jerry Kirsten.
Nice World Series dominant.
Jerry Kirsten, congratulations on victory number two on the world championship to
Thank
you here.
Thank you.
It's been a great year. And how does it feel?
It feels just great, just great. I couldn't say.
And as Jerry
better.
Says that I'm being doused with champagne, it's worth every minute of it, Jerry.
Good, want some in your mic?
No, no, we'll have a short circuit. Jerry Gentry, congratulations on a great year for you. This rookie year as a pitcher, and you're a big factor in this world championship. How does it feel?
It feels great. I just want to pitch one game, and that's all. Get it over with, baby. That's it. That's it. All the way.
Casey?
This club has already redone itself this year by its play because they beat everybody they contended. They're red hot now and they'll be red hot until next year.
Pearl Bailey here in the Mets clubhouse. Pearl, did you bring the Mets luck today?
No, I brought them truth. I told them in April, you know, that they would be number one. I spoke to Gil when the season started and made the prediction that they would be the number one team. On Monday, I predicted at the health club, I was there, and I told him the score would be 5-0. That's it. But yesterday I said that Sievers would not, he would not finish. Oh, that's nice and wet, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Soul.
You know, I really hate the way
champagne being poured down. Pearl Bailey here in the Mets clubhouse. Champagne time. We're both soaked in champagne. This is Brad Phillips.
There were even some light moments at the United Nations. In November 1966, after the Russians had cast their 104th veto in the Security Council, Ambassador Arthur Goldberg took time out to explain the origin of some unusual sounds that had been rattling the windows in the UN headquarters.
I'd like to make a brief announcement in my capacity as United States representative. We are not being blasted out of the UN by the blasting that you have heard. This is blasting that is taking place for a tunnel under the East River. The meeting is adjourned.
There were some people who got a lot of laughs over some disagreements at the White House as to what is art and what isn't. Portrait painter Peter Hurd had done a painting of President Johnson, who promptly declared it was the ugliest thing he ever saw. Artist Hurd was asked how he felt about that comment.
A shrug, I guess, a mental shrug. Too bad. Wish I hadn't flunked the course, that's all. I certainly hadn't worked very hard on the thing, and it's just the way the ball bounces.
The decade had an assortment of people who let their mouths get them into trouble. Spiro Agnew lived to regret saying, "If you've seen one slum, you've seen them all." The Beatles regretted one of their group saying the Beatles were bigger than Christ. Beatle Paul McCartney was sorry the Beatles had snubbed the wife of the president of the Philippines by not giving a private show, as they had promised to do.
The main misunderstanding is that we didn't know anything about it. Until it was much too late.
Paul McCartney later put to rest rumors that he was really dead, much to the relief of Beatles fans, who by the end of the 60s had become used to the antics of their idols, including their use of drugs and their rather public love affairs. Not that romance belonged only to the Beatles. Cupid had a busy decade. The two Johnson girls got married. So did Julie Nixon to David Eisenhower. Liz was married to Eddie and Richard in that order. Tiny Tim married Miss Vicky on nationwide television. And 67-year-old Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas married 23-year-old Catherine Heffernan.
Kathy's been working in the field
of sociology
and has been associated with a clinical group in Portland dealing with the problems of disturbed people. So she's been very close to a lot of the kind of problems that we have in the law, like the responsibility, criminal responsibility, responsibility for antisocial conduct, and so on. Those problems that are very conspicuous in the news these days. So this is her specialty, and I suppose it was that that was the intellectual interest that first brought us together.
The United States Supreme Court had a bad time in these 10 years, receiving criticism for its rulings on civil rights and the rights of criminals. But one of the most controversial of the court rulings was one that banned prayer in public schools, a ruling that prompted Senate Minority Leader Everett Dirksen to say,
"I don't want it to be said that there are two major countries in this world where in public places and public schools there can be no voluntary prayer, one being the Soviet Union and the other the United States of America. Shame on us!"
Dirksen, a familiar face and voice in the 60s, made some recordings and got a lot of mileage out of the idea that a politician had a right to go into show business if show business people, like Ronald Reagan, were going into politics. Every week, Dirksen could be counted on to appear on news programs discussing the weighty problems of the world, or with a parable to make a point.
"That old ostrich story, I've told it 100 times. About the rooster rolled that ostrich egg into the chicken coop, made a noise on the slats, got the attention of the chickens and said, 'Girls, I'm not dissatisfied with what you've been doing, but I roll this in here to show you it can be done.'"
And with the laughter, tears.
"We meet here in an hour of grief and challenge. Dag Hammarskjöld is dead.
I shall remain in my post during the term of office as a servant of the organization in the interest... I shall remain in my post during the term of my office as a servant of the organization in the interest of all those other nations as long as they wish me to do so."
But the United Nations lives. His tragedy is deep in our hearts, but the tasks for which he died are at the top of our agenda. A noble servant of peace is gone, but the quest for peace lies before us.
Dag Hammarskjöld died while on a mission for peace in the strife-torn Congo. His loss was felt around the world. But there were other losses felt by private people. The families of the crew of the nuclear submarine Thresher heard grim news from Admiral George Anderson.
"This is a very sad occasion for me, because very reluctantly I have come to the conclusion that the USS Thresher, which we held for a time as missing, has indeed been lost. I, on behalf of all of our people in the Navy, can give the greatest testimony to the contribution that these fine personnel of the Thresher have made to the future security of this country."
129 men perished on the Thresher, one of many disasters that marked this decade. Earthquakes in Yugoslavia and the Middle East, hurricanes on the Gulf Coast, and one Christmas time over New York City, two airplanes in a collision. December 16th, 1960, an eyewitness.
"It looked like a comet to me. One veered off in one direction, and another plane became quite visible and seemed to be out of control and going down. Crashed within a half a mile of where I lived. Completely afire. It was a horrible sight to watch."
134 killed. Tragedy and triumph, hand in hand. The stuff of life. Adlai Stevenson died on a street in London, July 14, 1965. His death brought a tribute from the President of the United States.
"The flame which illuminated the dreams and the expectations
of an entire world is now extinguished. Adlai Stevenson of Illinois is dead.
Triumph and tragedy. Dr. Martin Luther King. He said he had been to the mountaintop and saw the fulfillment of his dream. Triumph and tragedy. The decade of the 60s. It was the best of times, it was the worst of times, and now it is behind us, history. Yet out of it we have emerged not with despair or gloom or lack of faith, but with a looking ahead. Our eyes are to the front, to the future. And as we rang out the 60s and rang in the 70s, New York's Times Square was filled with that hope. This is Times Square, New Year's Eve, December 31st, 1969. The temperature is 26 degrees. It's 11:55 p.m. Eastern Time. I'm on the 17th floor of the Allied Chemical Building here in Times Square at the crossroads of the world. Just a few stories above me is the famous globe illuminated with electric lights, the globe on top of the tower. Just before the stroke of midnight, that globe will start to move. And when the globe completes its journey to the bottom, to the roof of the Allied Chemical Building, this will be marking the new year, the new decade, the 70s. Down below me, as far as the eye can see just about, the crowd, the traditional gathering on New Year's Eve. Crowd estimates have varied so far this evening. The closest we could come to guessing is just to say that there are thousands of people down there, perhaps 200,000. The weather has been rainy and snowy. The streets have been icy here in New York all day. There you hear a few firecrackers or cherry bombs going off down below in the crowd. The crowd seems to love that. This is a wonderful sort of tradition for New Yorkers and for visitors to New York. They gather here, they come here to forget the old year and to welcome the new. And this year is special. It is 1969. It is the end of the decade. To the Americans gathered below, what did the 60s mean? Well, the 60s meant the horrors of watching live on TV Lee Harvey Oswald shot by Jack Ruby. It was de Gaulle stepping down as leader of France. Perhaps the 60s are summed up for some in the birth control pill, which revolutionized morality and gave unique hope for controlling the population explosion. Even tonight, these people here in Times Square are under the threat of a bus and subway strike. The 60s were a time of strikes by municipal workers. Some of the people have come here to Times Square after seeing reflections of the 1960s shows and movies featuring sex and nudity. They help take one's mind off weighty issues like the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty of 1962, strategic arms limitation talks of 1969, the Soviet invasion of Czechoslovakia in 1968, the big Northeast power blackout in November of 65, the Berlin Wall, which went up in 1961, the day in 1964 when the communist Chinese set off their first nuclear bomb, heart transplants, the Pueblo crisis. There are those who adopted the slogan of 1966, turn on, tune in, drop out. There are those among the thousands here in Times Square who remember October 4th, 1965, when Pope Paul came to America, to New York. He spoke at the UN. He spoke in French, and his words were translated.
Never again. One against the other. Never again. Never more. Was it not principally for this purpose that the United Nations arose? Against war, in favor of peace? Listen to the lucid words of a great man, the late John Kennedy, who declared 4 years ago, mankind must put an end to war, or war will put an end to mankind.
The words of Pope Paul fade into history, and with just minutes to go, that illuminated globe atop the Allied Chemical Building, just a few stories above me, begins to move. It begins to start the slow slide, saying goodbye to the 60s and hello to the 70s. And here from the 17th floor, we turn and look at the crowd stretching from 40th Street all the way up to 48th Street on Broadway. Thousands and thousands of people as far as the eye can see. The lights of Broadway all turning skyward to watch this globe now halfway down
The time is 11:59. Just seconds, literally seconds to go. And in a few moments, a few seconds, now, 1970, the 60s are gone. It's 1970, and listen to the crowd below. Firecrackers go off, a gigantic searchlight comes on, spotlighting us and spotlighting the sign which says 1970. We have seen the 60s and the 60s are gone. Goodbye to a decade. Hello to another.